This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Louise Erdrich was honored by the state of North Dakota last Friday in Wahpeton. Governor Jack Dalrymple presented Erdrich with the Rough Rider Award, the state's highest honor. She is the third author to win the award with Louis L'Amour and Larry Wywoody, and the 39th Rough Rider honoree. Erdrich graduated from Dartmouth College and received her graduate degree in fine arts from Johns Hopkins University. She's written 14 novels, children's stories, poetry, and a memoir. Her most recent book, The Roundhouse, won the National Book Award for Fiction. Here's some of what Governor Dalrymple had to say.
Louise graduated from Dartmouth College, I've heard of that, and received a Master of Fine Arts degree from Johns Hopkins University. She is the author of 14 novels, as well as volumes of poetry, children's books, and a memoir of early motherhood. In 1984, her novel Love Medicine won the National Book Critics Circle Award. The last report on the miracles at Little Nohorse was a finalist for the National Book Award. The Plague of Doves won the Annisfield Wolf Book Award and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2009. The Plague of Doves was named a Best Book of the Year by the Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, San Francisco Chronicle, and the Christian Science Monitor. One reviewer had this to say about Louise's novel: Erdrich's imaginative freedom has reached its zenith. The Plague of Doves is her dazzling masterpiece. That reviewer was a guy that some people in literature have heard of, Philip Roth. On November 15th, 2012, she won the National Book Award for her latest novel, The Roundhouse. USA Today had this to say about her work: one can only marvel at Erdrich's amazing ability to do what so few of us can, shape words into phrases and sentences of incomparable beauty that then pour forth a mesmerizing story. To quote the namesake of this historic award, Theodore Roosevelt, "Far and away, the best prize that life has to offer is the chance to work hard at work worth doing." Louise, throughout your career, you have worked hard at work worth doing, and you are being recognized tonight for that hard work and all it represents for our state. On behalf of the people of North Dakota, it is my privilege to name you the 39th recipient of the North Dakota Theodore Roosevelt Rough Rider Award. Louise, please come forward.
That's North Dakota Governor Jack Dalrymple last Friday. Erdrich's official Rough Rider portrait will be hung in the Great Hall in the state capitol. Was unveiled that evening. She was given a sculpture of Theodore Roosevelt. And in return, Erdrich presented a traditional Pendleton turtle blanket from the Turtle Mountain Chippewa as a gift to the governor and first lady, Betsy Dalrymple. Erdrich considers Wahpeton home. It's where she grew up, where her parents taught at the Bureau of Indian Affairs School, and it's one of the places that informs her writing. Erdrich shared three readings from her work that evening. Here's one of those readings.
I'm going to read a little bit tonight, not a lot, but three pieces. And they are all, I think, pieces that could be only, they could really only happen in North Dakota. That's why I chose them, all right? This first one is dedicated to my father, Ralph Erdrich. It's called Living Dangerously. Although my parents were so concerned for my personal safety that they constructed a padded helmet for me to wear while learning to toddle, they nevertheless had the courage to introduce me to controlled and joyous dangers. In 1965, my father, who ardently loved winter fun, invented ditch skiing. It's just like water skiing, except the boat is a car and the water is the frozen snow. It is a sport that can only be done, of course, where ditches flow endlessly beside straight, flat roads, where snow is boundless and there is no other cars or fences. North Dakota was perfect. I stood in the snowy margin of the road with my skis strapped on. My father tied a long hemp rope to the bumper of our car. I grasped the knotted end, held on, determined not to fall or let go, unless, of course, I did fall, in which case I must let go. Otherwise, I was told, and I was certain, I would be killed. A moment of anticipation held. Then my father, in his battered white army parka with a scruffy fur collar, got back in the car, rolled down the window, looked back, and waited for my signal. At my shout, he started the engine. At my nod, he took off, looking back at me, forward at the road. Slowly at first, then faster, faster, he drove into the white distance. The sun stood directly over me, magnetic and pale. The small, even, wind-blown waves of snow wrapped angrily beneath the scratched wood of my skis. Cold snow dust stung my face, and the tow rope was a lifeline, another kind of cord connecting my father and me. During the next few years, I turned into a preteen and a teenager who insisted on wearing nylons to walk to school on 40 below mornings. I endured frostbitten ankles, prayed at night to be popular, practiced smiles and frowns before the bathroom mirror while my younger brothers and sisters hammered on the door, and took up the less physically demanding but more complex sport of winter skating. I skated with my father. He taught me jumps, turns, and we attempted to ice dance, joined arm in arm, spinning and practice control. With his strength behind a turn, I could vault into the air. In his protection, I leaned on perilous edges. For my winters of living dangerously were preparations for survival, and he was always behind me. I still see us arm in arm in our old black coats, our dull skates pinching as we skated the figure eight, the symbol of eternity, over and over on new ice until the white marks cut deeper, deeper, a chalked Mobius of love.
That's Louise Erdrich receiving North Dakota's Rough Rider Award from Governor Dalrymple on Friday evening in Wahpeton at the North Dakota State College of Science. North Dakota's Rough Rider Award confers the honorary title of Colonel in Teddy Roosevelt's Rough Riders. It was started during the 1961 Dakota Territory Centennial to recognize current or former North Dakotans who've achieved national recognition in their fields. The first recipient was Lawrence Welk. Prairie Public's television service will broadcast an hour-long special about Erdrich and her award this Thursday at 7 o'clock Central Time. Coming up on Main Street, Ashley Thornburg interviews Bill Law at NDSU's brand new School of Music about that brand new designation. Then we'll hear about an outreach from the University of Minnesota about physics, how to make that entertaining. And they're on their way to Bismarck with this act. Then Tom Ezern has a Plainsfolk column today and, of course, a Dakota Date book. All this is coming up on Main Street in just a moment.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Tonight's television lineup on Prairie Public starts with Jungle Eagle on Nature. Then at 8 Central, NOVA presents Australia's First 4 Billion Years. Tonight's episode, Monsters. And at 9, we stay in Australia for another episode of Nature called Kangaroo Mob. Tune in tonight on Prairie Public.
Welcome back to Main Street. I'm Ashley Thornburg. You're listening to Swimming Into Winter. It's a mixed choral instrumental written by Minneapolis composer Jocelyn Hagen, performed by choir and band students from North Dakota State University. And you may be a little surprised to learn that this music is, in effect, something of a side effect of NDSU's move to Division I athletics. During that decade-long transition, then-President Joe Chapman challenged the university to accelerate in more than just sports. There's been an upgrade in the amount and quality of research and an increased number of doctoral degrees. The music department responded with great enthusiasm to the challenge, and here to talk about it is Bill Law. Bill, your voice is a familiar one to our jazz-loving audience. You host the Law of Jazz on Prairie Public on Saturday nights. But we're letting you out of your normal time slot and to talk about some of the recent successes that you're having in your day job as the assistant director from the Division of Fine Arts at NDSU. Bill, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me here. Thanks so much.
Your bachelor's degree in music is from NDSU, and your master's is from MSU Moorhead. And this is a fairly common track for kids across the region, but that's about as high as you can go with a music degree, or at least it was.
Exactly. That's at least it was. NDSU recently became a school of music, NDSU Department of Music, which was officially designated a department in 1952. And due to some significant changes in what we offer, and I'm specifically talking about offering doctoral degrees in performance and conducting in music, We changed our designation from a Department of Music to a School of Music, better reflecting the size and scope of the department. This makes us one of a small number of peer institutions who are accredited and offer the scope of degrees that we do offer.
It's fewer than 50 across the nation, right?
49, exactly. And so it puts us in a really elite peer pool. And then the other notable fact is that we're the only doctoral awarding institution in the upper tier of states between the Twin Cities and the West Coast. So we're finding that our students are coming from many of the best undergraduate programs in the region, and we're seeing interest from national and international students as well.
Yeah, I want to know, what does this mean both in terms of recruitment and retention of students for North Dakota?
Well, you know, North Dakota, I don't have to tell you this, but North Dakota has become kind of a interesting oasis, you know, in a sea of deficits and program slashing at the same time that we're seeing surpluses in program building. So that works, of course, in our favor. But I think offering the range of things that we offer in the environment that we offer it, it's not a diploma factory. We don't have 1,500 students, so the students that we do have an opportunity to work on their craft in a very nurturing sort of a program. They're going to get time on the podium. They're going to get time in front of performing organizations. They're going to have lots of opportunities to play, and they're not going to have to wait in line for that to happen.
What's the ratio of students to faculty in this program?
Well, I think NDSU is roughly 20 to 1. You know, in our program, you know, and especially when you're talking about graduate programs, that number is much smaller. But I think our typical class size probably isn't any bigger than, let's say, 30 or 35 students. You know, a lot of the classes are smaller than that. I think NDSU is officially in that sort of 18 to 20 to 1 range for, you know, as an average for their classes. So it's, you know, in terms of, you know, national statistics, that's a pretty good, I think the ratio faculty to students is pretty good.
And it's certainly something that, like you said, between Minneapolis and the West Coast, there just weren't options.
Right. So I'm kind of a living example of the, you know, the wall being, you know, at the master's degree, and had considered at one point, you know, moving away, getting a doctoral degree, which is not an unusual path, due to a different kind of opportunity or opportunities in my life. I didn't do that, but didn't have that opportunity to pursue the degree, the doctoral degree, in my own backyard, so to speak. You know, I think it's really a wonderful opportunity for regional, you know, top regional students, many of whom are educational professionals coming back to accelerate their skills as conductors and performers, some of whom are looking to get into higher ed, you know, a leap from, you know, public education into higher ed, or just to accelerate their skills and be, you know, top-ranked public school teachers. So, you know, the opportunity to get a doctoral degree at NDSU, you know, is, I think, a huge asset to the North Dakota University system and to our immediate community, our immediate region. Brings a lot of really, really talented people back into the Fargo-Moorhead area. And we've been very successful at placing our graduates of the program into regional universities. So we have people at Dickinson State, for instance, people at Black Hills State in South Dakota, places like that. We have a recent graduate at Morris right now. So we're starting to, you know, see both the endorsement and the, I think, and populate the fine arts openings in the region. It's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, one of the thresholds they always talk about for, you know, judging cities and states is it's a center of commerce or a center of culture.
Right.
And, you know, it's kind of putting North Dakota on the map.
Yeah, I think Fargo-Moorhead has always been unique. One of the great arts patrons of the community now has passed, but Ruth Landfield always called Fargo the Athens on the Plains. You know, and I think that's even more true now than it was 20 years ago. And, you know, part of that is the university environment that drives the culture in this region. You know, we're clearly a college town. I'm saying town, but I mean Fargo-Moorhead, West Fargo, Dilworth, Glendon, Felton, that, you know, that whole 20-mile, you know, circle around the Fargo-Moorhead area. But it's clearly dominated by not just agriculture, but it's dominated by, you know, the university environment.
So what is the program like? Can you walk me through a few of the upper tier classes?
Well, it's a typical advanced degree program in that we, you know, the students come in and they have to study theory and history and they have to learn how to do research alongside the applied skills, which would be conducting and performance. And the performance can be instrumental performance or it can be vocal performance. And they just log lots and lots of hours, you know, at a very, they get very geeky and they get down and dirty with the details about things. And I mean, you know, you think somebody standing in front of a choral group waving their hands, you know, how hard could it be? And yet,
how hard is it?
For some reason, well, I can't do it. I can beat, you know, a few basic patterns, but, you know, I sit through a lot of concerts. I've seen more concerts than most people ever will. And I watch ensembles and I hear a different sound coming from the same group of performers with a different conductor in front of them. Every time it's still, you know, amazing and stunning to me that you can wave your hands. You can't see this, but I'm making patterns, but that you can wave your hands and make a difference in the way people respond to you. So that's the down and dirty, you know, geeky part of doing this. You know, how do you make a group respond to you? What is the body language, you know, both with hands and facial expressions that allows them to respond to you and do what it is that you want them to do? You know, louder, softer, more expressive. You know, you're talking in some cases about text and music. With instrumentalists, you're talking about different timbres and textures with instrument combinations. What do you want them to do? You know, the dots on the page are just a roadmap. You know, they're not really music. They're just a representation of music. And then the conductor's job is to make magic, you know. And I see that happen, and I see it not happen. And I think that's the trip or the journey for those students, you know, is learning how to make that magic happen.
And you've been celebrating this magical journey that the university's been on here. Really an exciting year, even beyond the designation of School of Music. Record performances, performing Handel's Messiah. What else is going on?
Well, this is, you know, the designation as the School of Music was really just the switch that allowed us to go into, you know, the celebration of this change to a School of Music. In addition to things like our annual Messiah performance, we've had several instrumental performances in the fall semester that were devoted to larger scale residencies. One featured Thomas Hooton, who is a principal trumpet player of the Los Angeles Philharmonic. One featured composer David Maslanka, a residency with him that featured one of his symphonic pieces, which, you know, honestly pushed our students to their limits. And when they were done, it was like, yeah, this was really cool, you know, to have that experience and then to have the composer there and getting feedback directly from the source of the music. In the spring semester, we did a couple of really interesting things. One was a performance of a concert featuring our concert choir and our wind symphony at the Ordway Center in downtown St. Paul. And this was an event that was marketed, so to speak, to our many friends and alums in the Twin Cities. Had a great time. Our president was there, and one of our distinguished alums was there, our dean, the director of the Division of Fine Arts, John Miller, my partner, and all of these things. Had a wonderful concert in a wonderful facility, and then 2 weeks later did the same thing at Festival Hall here in Fargo, again celebrating, and lots of people coming to see this who are really excited, connected to the university, not just fine arts folks, but, you know, people who are interested in the success and growth of NDSU.
And a couple of notes here just to end this. The NDSU Choral Symposium presenting Music of the Americas, May 3rd through 5th. This has speakers from Venezuela, Mexico City, some people who are currently living in Canada working as musical professionals. And there's also going to be the American Spiritual Ensemble. And this is a free performance coming up on Saturday, May 4th.
You definitely don't want to miss the American Spiritual Ensemble. That'll be something that will change your life. And it's free.
Spoken like a man who knows. Bill Law is the Assistant Director from the Division of Fine Arts at NDSU and, of course, host of Prairie Public Radio's program, The Law of Jazz, which airs Saturday from 8 to 9 p.m. Bill, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me here.
The news is next.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. After earlier predicting a river crest of 41 feet at Fargo, officials with the National Weather Service have again revised those numbers, this time a downward revision.
That range, we've now effectively lowered it a bit, so we're looking at the 38 to 40 foot range as the target zone. 40 feet is taking into account that expectation for heavy rain, possibly even thunderstorms, Tuesday and Wednesday of next week.
Weather Service spokesman Greg Gust says the latest numbers show the region has dodged yet another bullet this spring.
You know, the amount of precipitation, if you look at the last couple of weeks that's been moving across the central and northern plains, has been pretty huge. So every couple, 3-4 days, there's a pretty heavy precipitation event that's hitting somewhere between, you know, Omaha and Fargo and moving across the central into the northern plains. We've missed most of that. And so if we do get some next week, that's a bullet, but it's not near as many as have been aimed this direction at this point.
Gus says with the ongoing delays in the spring thaw, it will be well into May before the flood threat has fully crossed the international border. As the Red River Valley readies for its spring river flooding season, the people of Devil's Lake Basin sit and wait. Ramsey County Emergency Manager Kristen Nelson says the two outlets on Devil's Lake cannot pump any water until rivers in the valley get back down to lower levels. And with predictions that the lake could rise 2 feet this year, that has a lot of people feeling uneasy.
You know, people get upset and There's loss of homes, loss of land, which means loss of dollars in their pockets, as well as the communities as well. Overall, it's an extreme hardship, and with a lake flood that we suffer from here, it's so catastrophic, and it's an awful thing to experience. But the thing with our flood is our water doesn't just recede after a week, few weeks, 6 weeks, however long, like a river flood. They're both detrimental. It's just that we sit here with ours, and if the rivers to the south of us are at full capacity, we're not able to let our water spill over and let our water go.
Last year, dry conditions aided the pumps in taking off nearly 3 feet of floodwaters from Devil's Lake, which had swollen to its highest ever elevation of 1,454.3 feet in 2011. That drop in the lake level freed up 30,000 acres in 2012. Nelson says it's likely that this year that land will once again be lost. She says the unstable water levels, land, and roads can become impassable throughout Ramsey and Benson counties.
So with some of our county roads and our rural roads potentially going back under or having no travel on them due to water running over or debris and whatnot, it makes it difficult for our residents to get to and fro, possibly get home. It arises a potential threat for our EMS here in the area, for our Lake Region ambulances and our other rural ambulances as well, to be able to get to people, to be able to get to rural homes, farmsteads, and things like that.
Devil's Lake has had unstable elevations for many decades and has roughly quadrupled in size since 1993. And North Dakota voters will be asked to approve a constitutional amendment that would put some restrictions on initiated measures that spend money. The resolution that says initiated measures that spend money need to be voted on in the general election, not the primary. And it says proposed constitutional amendments that set up continuing appropriations would not be allowed at all. Minot Senator David Hoag was a member of the conference committee that came up with that language.
We think the policy is if you're going to propose a measure that spends money on a continuous basis, it should be a statutory measure.
Senate Minority Leader Max Schneider of Grand Forks says this kind of measure is not necessary.
I think the people have used the power of the initiated measure process very responsibly. In fact, the example cited by my friend from Minot, Measure 2, which was actually during the June 2012 election, that went down overwhelmingly. And so I think that is a vindication and a validation of the people in the way that they use this power.
The measure passed 29-18. It will now be on the ballot in 2014. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and now for something completely different. If you've heard of the Force is with them, of course, from Star Wars and all that, well, this is the metaphysical force they're talking about. We're talking about the actual physics force, and we're going to talk about it with Jack Netland, a retired physics teacher at Maple Grove Senior High School in suburban Twin Cities. He joins us on the phone. Hello, Jack.
Hello there.
And Scott Chakovsky, assistant professor of chemistry at Bismarck State College, joins us from our studio in Bismarck. Hello, Scott.
Hello.
Let's get right into this. The physics force is actually a very entertaining group of, well, science teachers who go around and wow the audience, typically of K through 12 audiences, kids who are in public schools, about the wonderful magic of real science. And Scott, when and where are folks in Bismarck going to see the physics force?
Well, we have just one offering of physics force. It's Friday, May 3rd at 6:30 p.m., and it's going to be held at St. Mary's Central High School.
6:30
p.m., right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's right. That's what it is. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and who's coming?
Well, there will be – oh, are you asking me or are you asking Scott?
I'm asking Scott yet.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The audience is going to be varied. It's going to be all the way down to, you know, the youngest crowd, kindergarten on up, to high school students and adults that might be interested in learning more about science.
All right. Well, thank you, Scott. And now, Jack, you've been at this now. It seems to me this whole thing started about 30 years ago.
Almost, yeah. We started in 1985 with shows at the University of Minnesota in their lecture hall.
Well, tell us about that. Where did the idea come from and who got this going?
Well, this was rather an interesting development. It was kind of serendipitous in that there was a fellow at the university at that time. His name was Phil Johnson, and he was the lecture apparatus expert at the university for the physics professors there. And he was at a conference in Maryland, and Two of my friends, Hank Ryan and John Barber, were at that conference, and they got to talking about being some connection between the University of Minnesota and a bunch of high school teachers, because this guy Phil felt as though sometimes those guys in the physics department were kind of standing up there looking down on everybody, and could there be some connection? And so they set this thing up, and he worked with us and got he knew pretty much all the demonstrations that are known at the university anyway. And so he said, let's make a show where we will have a theme. And so we started off with a theme show, and it became quite popular, and juniors and seniors came to the show, and they enjoyed that. And so finally they wanted more shows, so he said, okay, let's do three shows a year. And so then we went to three shows, and this is about 1987 or 88. And then we went to three shows a year, and then we changed, so we had six different shows, so a student could come as a junior and a senior and never see the same show twice. So then it got to be that people wanted us to come out and do shows in their area, and so we started doing that in the early 90s and mid-90s. And then Dan Dahlberg, who was the physics professor that worked with us on the shows, Dan Dahlberg is a low-temperature condensed matter physicist.
And we all know what those are about.
And you all know what that is, sure. And so, in fact, I'm not sure what it is, but it really sounds pretty good when you say that. And so anyway, he's a condensed matter physicist, and he wanted to work with the shows. And so he said, let's look at some youngsters, younger people, because what we want to do is encourage people to become involved in science. By the time the kids are junior, they're already there. They know whether or not they're going to do it. So he's...
Oh, we're having some cutout here with Jack. Scott, while we're working on Jack, can you give us a sense of the importance of STEM students, those science, technology, engineering, and math students you're trying to get in the doors at Bismarck State, for that matter?
Absolutely. The same thought that Jack had, that we're targeting younger and younger kids so that we can get them interested in science at a young age and hopefully carry that interest so that they do attend places like Bismarck State College and study in those needed areas of chemistry and engineering and the other sciences.
And how is enrollment in those areas for you?
We've seen some dips with the impact in the oil development, but overall enrollments have been quite strong.
Well, Scott and Jack, are demos in these classes designed to get attention and improve retention? Is that the science behind the presentation?
Right. I teach in the chemistry discipline. And I do a lot of demonstrations, and the primary goal is just to get attention and get some interest, and then hopefully teach something along with that demonstration. And the more interest we can generate, the longer we can keep the kids involved in that area.
I can certainly remember my science classes. I always perked up when the demos happened. And Jack, there are some interesting names to the physics circus demonstrations. And one that you do often with your colleague, I think it's Hank Ryan, is the Monkey and Hunter. Can you describe that to us? We still don't have Jack there, I guess. There you go. There you are, Jack. Can you hear me now?
I can, yes.
I think I've heard that somewhere.
Yeah, so now the Monkey and the Hunter is classically, the legend goes that there's a hunter in the middle of the jungle. He sees a monkey hanging from a tree. He shoots at him. Now, as he shoots at him, the monkey sees the puff of the smoke, and he immediately drops because he's going to get away from the bullet. Question is, where do you aim so that you can, in fact, hit that monkey in broad fall? And so we set it up so that we hit the monkey. The monkey, in this case, is actually Aaron Pinsky. Hank can't do it anymore because his doctor won't let him.
Okay, you guys have aged along with the act a bit.
Yes, we have. Hank and I are 70 years old now, and so we have to be a little careful about what we do.
Congratulations.
It was nice to get here, actually. But the demonstrations are fun, and we have a mantra, and it says, physics is interesting, it's understandable, and it can be fun. And so that's what we go out. We've been trying to push that for 30 years.
Well, you've got a whole list of these things here. They sound, the names sound like a lot of fun. The giant puffer, the egg and sheet, the human rocket, the howitzer and tunnel. So how do you come up with this stuff? I mean, I assume some of them are classics that you've been doing in classrooms, but now you're putting it on stage in front of a crowd. You've got to add that showmanship piece to it.
Well, you know, as a teacher, especially in high school or a public school system, you're not that far from an entertainer because kids have grown up watching Newton's apple Sesame Street and all these educational things where things move very rapidly, and they kind of expect that a little bit in the classroom. Some people don't like the idea, but whether you like it or not, you're kind of there. And so that's what you do in the classroom, and we just took that and adapted it to a stage program.
So do you have some instruction or somebody give you some ideas about stagecraft, about the scale of things to make? I mean, you bring a cannon out on stage for the monkey and hunter.
Yes, we do. And we have and the rocket cart is a full-size bicycle wheel cart. And, yeah, all these things are large, and because we say to ourselves, what could be better than something small that you can see. Well, something big that you can see is even better.
Of course.
you can crush a pop can with air pressure, or you can take a 55-gallon drum, 18-gauge steel drum, and crush it in a split second. That's pretty impressive.
You know, I remember, and this is decades ago now, but the late Steve Allen had this late-night show where he actually would do some of these fantastic scientific demonstrations, and one was involving that boiling water in a great big can. Then they had all these fire hoses with cold water on it to make it crumple. It was great.
So anyway, we have a lot of fun. We have more fun, actually, than the audience does.
And you mentioned something else that you've done. You were on Newton's Apple television show.
Yes, I was on Newton's Apple from 85 to 97. I did about three segments a year during that time. They also wanted some connection with high school people, as opposed to having all experts in the field. And so I became one of their regulars.
Scott, how you been getting the word out? We want a nice crowd there at that high school for Physics Force on 6:30 on Friday the 3rd of May.
Absolutely. We've been distributing free tickets for the program. It is a free event, and the tickets are very easy to obtain. You can either pick them up at Gateway to Science here in Bismarck, or you can, in fact, go to their website, www.gatewaytoscience.org, and print them right on the website.
Okay, so looking forward to that. I've actually seen this show. I saw it about 10 years ago across the river when you came to Morehead State, and you really wowed the crowd of kids at that particular show.
Yes.
And I also notice when I go online, because you can go online, you can look up Physics Force, and you can actually see a demonstration video. That's where I saw the monkey and the hunter.
Yes.
And at the front of the video, very tellingly, it says, "Warning, do not attempt these experiments without adult supervision in a supervised laboratory."
Yes, some of them can get quite dangerous, actually, if you don't know what you're doing. And sometimes they're dangerous even for us.
Oh, what's your most memorable moment in front of an audience with the Physics Force?
Well, the most memorable moment was probably when we had a young man come up from the audience to throw an egg into a sheet. And he was a pitcher for the baseball team in Jackson, Minnesota. And he threw the egg as hard as he could, and he missed a sheet. So now we got a pitcher who missed a sheet. So we said, well, let's do it again. Well, we didn't have any more eggs. So we just went on with the show. At the end of the show, this lady comes up out of the audience. She says, "Here, I went and bought some eggs. That's my son. You give him another chance." And so we did. And he hit the sheet, and all was well. But I'll never forget that one.
And what were you demonstrating with an egg and a sheet?
We were demonstrating that if you give something time to stop, the force on it is not that big.
All right.
Yeah, and in fact, not even big enough to crack the shell of an egg.
You're retired, obviously, and have been retired for some time. You taught at Maple Grove Senior High.
I did. Mm-hmm.
How much time do you spend on the road now with this?
Well, it depends on the year. Some years we've had maybe 25 or 30 shows. Last year we had like five or six. It seems to be dwindling some. So we don't know. As long as we're having fun, we'll keep on doing them. But I teach part-time at Bethel University as well.
Any estimate how many people have seen a Physics 4 show up to now?
Well, with what we do at the Minneapolis Convention Center and then the shows that we do out around the area, it's about between 25,000 and 30,000 a year.
Okay. Well, I notice also you have some merchandise. You got a DVD and T-shirt. So
yes, we obviously do. Yeah. Houghton Mifflin did a DVD, and they were going to use it in a book as a resource for a book that they were going to sell, but they never did. And they said, "Here, you guys, you can use it." So what we do is sell it and use the proceeds to put on more shows.
Now, I came across an article. You have it up on the website. That's from the Star Tribune back before even 2000.
Yes.
And at that time, they said there was a handful of such groups in the nation. Is that still the case? Are there still just a few physics forces or their like around?
There are just a few that go out and will bring a show to your area. Yeah, I think there are quite a few of them. Now, maybe Scott could talk to this more. There are several at the colleges and universities.
Physics Force is the only one that I know of. We have had chemistry demonstrators come in, but nothing of the scale of the Physics Force event.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, and in fact, as far as we know, we're the only team that does the monkey and the hunter with a human being.
And a big cannon, yeah.
And a big cannon with a billiard ball, yeah.
Scott, is this something that people who teach physics or chemistry or these demonstration sciences like to catch to get an idea, for example, of how to turn their students on to the facts of science?
Oh, absolutely. The students who attend and the instructors who might be in the audience are going to benefit greatly. They're going to bring these demonstrations back to their classes and attempt to use them just the same as during the Physics 4 show.
Well, thanks very much for joining us today. Again, that show is Friday, May 3rd at 6:30 at what school again?
St. Mary's Central High School.
St. Mary's Central High School in Bismarck. That's Scott Chakovsky, Assistant Professor of Chemistry at Bismarck State College. And on the phone, Jack Netland, retired physics teacher at Maple Grove Senior High, a member of the Physics Force. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Thank you.
More Main Street in a moment.
Do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. Just email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or send us a message via the Main Street at Prairie Public Facebook page. And you can still call. The Main Street toll-free studio line is 888-755-6377.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. In the background there, music from the School of Music. That is NDSU's School of Music. This is from their Celebration Concerts CD. And that was the NDSU Wind Symphony playing there. Well, every week, Tom Ezrin comes by with a Plains Folk column. And this week's column is titled, No New Story.
On the level of our house that is devoted to office and library, I keep a great bison leather chair angled toward the fireplace. This is my reading chair, and sometimes a napping chair, but those two often are seamless. Because really, what I'm talking about is a place of comfort. Sometimes in the bison chair, I need comfort reading, and that's when I reach for a volume of Cather, some nice substantial work as published in Deluxe Edition by the University of Nebraska Press. I read all kinds of literature, but Willa Cather, especially, of course, O Pioneers and My Antonia, satisfies like no other, and is comfortable, too. As a historian, I can get a little prickly about matters of fact and reliability. Fiction or nonfiction, I expect an author to know the country she writes about intimately. Cather knows the prairies. Years ago, I began cataloging all the references by Cather to bits of natural history, the plants and animals she mentions. I have found but one case in which I think she errs in a reference to nature on the prairies, and countless times where she alludes to some detail with the familiarity of an affectionate native. People who love Cather will be interested in a little essay she published in The Nation magazine in 1923, Nebraska, the End of the First Cycle. It's full of those little details of history and natural history that show she loves the land. How the first telegraph message to flash across the Missouri River was, "Westward the course of empire takes its way." How travelers and pioneers of the prairies loved the native coreopsis, Coreopsis tinctoria, and referred to it as lagoon flower. A few weeks ago came word that scholars had published a new book presenting for the first time the private letters of Willa Cather, who had provided in her will that her private writings should never be published. I'm a little ambivalent about this. On the one hand, her wishes were clear. On the other hand, Cather belongs to all of us. It's a moot point, but one thing is plain from this new look into the world of Cather. In late life, she was a sad woman. And that is a sad fact, to think that the woman whose lyric prose celebrated the prairies and their people more beautifully and triumphantly than any others, herself ended up so unhappy. So I look back at that 1923 essay, written from the standpoint of middle age, and there are signs of things to come. Cather still exults in the long, red, shaggy grass, the bluestem prairies, and in the underdog accomplishments of her immigrant neighbors on the plains. At the same time, she hints that perhaps our best days are behind us. "People these days," Cather writes in 1923, "want to buy everything ready-made, clothes, food, education, music, pleasure. People have been spoiled," she says, "by too much prosperity, too many moving picture shows, too much gaudy fiction." She frets about the younger generation, asking, "Will it believe that to live easily is to live happily?" In contrast, she lionizes the pioneers whose story is finished and says, "No new story worthy to take its place has yet begun." I believe that I am saved from the sort of sadness suffered by Cather, because I live a life filled with beautiful young people who treat me well. I'm reminded, though, how important it is to tell good stories about life on the prairies and not get wrapped up in the golden past. The story is not over. It has barely begun.
That's Tom Easer, an NDSU history professor, with this week's Plainsfolk column. Coming up, Dakota Datebook.
Peter Sagal here. It is so frustrating that I've been doing the show, wait, don't tell me, for so long, and I don't know what you all look like. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to simulcast our show live from New York City on May 2nd to theaters all over the country. And I want you to come to the theater. I want you to stare at the screen. And if I peer into the camera hard enough, I think I'll be able to see you. That's wait, don't tell me, live in theaters on May 2nd.
That's coming up May 2nd at the Grand Theater in Bismarck and Century 10 in Fargo at 7 p.m. More information at prairiepublic.org/radio. Support for this program is provided by Beaver Creek Archaeology of Bismarck, enriching public understanding and appreciation of culturally, historically, and ecologically significant areas. Learn more at bcarch.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 24th. On a cool but sunny March morning in 1944, schoolteacher Pauline Rebel was preparing the one-room Wild Plum Schoolhouse, 20 miles south of Richardton, North Dakota, for the arrival of her 8 students. It appeared to be a day like any other, but after the students arrived, strange things began to happen. At first, lumps of coal began to hop around in the coal bucket, like Mexican jumping beans, higher and higher, until the coal bounced off the walls. An invisible force moved books and other items around the room. Then the coal began to burn, and the curtains and a bookcase caught fire. 2 girls screamed that they saw a ghostly black hooded man outside the schoolhouse. Miss Rebel had no choice but to cancel school and call the authorities. The superintendent of schools brought in the state fire marshal to look for the source of the fires, and they sent samples of coal to the University of North Dakota for analysis. They made arrangements with the FBI to analyze the coal, the coal bucket, and a dictionary from the bookshelf for anything that could explain the supernatural events at the Wild Plum School. The tale of the haunted schoolhouse made national news. The fearful stories of the haunted coal and the hooded man ran in papers across the U.S., and on this date, Time magazine's science section told the story. Shortly before the story appeared in Time, however, the source of the haunting had been discovered. Pauline Rebel's students came forward and admitted that they had engineered the haunting. Miss Rebel had very poor eyesight, even with glasses, and the students had started pranking the nearsighted teacher in January. Because they didn't get caught, the students escalated the pranks until they were hiding matches in the coal bucket and between pages of books on the bookshelf and poking things with yardsticks to make it look like a ghost did it. Now that state officials and possibly the FBI were involved, the students decided to admit their hijinks. Time magazine ran a retraction in the May 1st issue, but even though the truth is known, books published today still tell the story of the haunted Wild Plum Schoolhouse as though it was a true unsolved mystery. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Derek Dahlsed. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Listen to our podcast or a previous broadcast anytime, anywhere. In your home or on your phone, you can catch Main Street on any street. All day, all night, a friend in Fiji or your aunt in Vermont can tune into a show you just know they'd want to hear, or they can browse older shows for other topics of interest. Our app and archives are easy to find. They're right on Main Street, in the radio neighborhood at prairiepublic.org.
Thursday on Main Street, a UND researcher and her team have demonstrated for the first time that a molecule involved in the human body's initial response to an infection or trauma may be the key in preventing sepsis. That's a life-threatening medical condition. And tomorrow, I get to visit with microbial immunologist Jyotika Sharma and David S. Bradley, chair of the Department of Microbiology at UND.
I also have a health-related story. There is a new website that, within an hour of its launch, was already making a difference in the lives of distressed students and their families. And sometimes their families don't even live in this country. And I will talk with two health professionals about what's going on across campuses and what they're doing to help.
And of course, tomorrow is Thursday. It's What's Happening Day on Main Street.
I've already started.
You have,
I got some good ones.
You're ahead of me. Okay. We'll look forward to that. And of course, we'll have more Dakota Datebook. And of course, the weather is on everybody's mind. This winter that will not end, it appears to be getting ready to break and become spring again.
Finally.
Okay. That's Main Street for today. You have a wonderful evening.